I read this yesterday in the Globe and Mail in a column that was subtitled Broken Europe. The author spoke of the repairs to the economies of the various countries that are happening, and he wrote this: but a return to growth is not a return to certainty. That's now gone forever. Certainty, he learned during a six-country tour and after numerous interviews, is the main victim of the crash, he wrote. No longer are jobs, houses, savings, or futures sure in the Western world. And that's the question now looming over the world. What is stable? What is reliable? What worked? What sort of life is worth pursuing now, if so much can melt away in an instant? That question, looming over the world in the author's words, what sort of life is worth pursuing if so much can melt away in an instant? I think it's answered for us in our reading for today. Death is a teacher. Whether it's the death of certainty, a way of life, the end of a dream that kept you going, the loss of someone that you love, the end of a relationship that's central to your life, or just plain death, your own death. As a teacher, it can teach us by its very presence. It can help us to sort out what's really important from the smaller concerns that usually crowd our minds and our days and that somehow melt away in the presence of death. It is then that we are able to see with rare clarity what is really worthy of attention, our devotion, and our time. I read an interesting sermon. I love reading collections of sermons, see what people do with texts, and every once in a while you run into one that gives you some ideas. But I read a very interesting sermon by Martin Copenhaver, who's a very distinguished American preacher who regularly comes to the homiletics conference that Anthony and I have attended. And it was called Building Barns and Postponing Life. And he tries to imagine what it would be like to make a pastoral call on this rich man's widow to plan his memorial service. He says he would have seen him only rarely at church, so he asks her about what was important to him. And he imagines the widow, still in shock, saying, well, his children were very important to him. I hope they know that. He always carried his picture around with him in his wallet. And he loved me, she said. We used to do lots and lots of things together, take quiet walks and talk about the kids. And he planned to do that too one day when he retired. One day, he told us, we will do the same things that we always loved. He never stopped believing in God, but, you know, life got so, so busy that he had very little time for church. He was indeed a very successful farmer. He was under a lot of pressure. He ate the farm and he dreamed the farm. And he expected that things would get easier tomorrow, someday, soon. He often said, you know, this won't last forever. And he told himself one day he would have plenty of good things laid up for himself for many years, and then he'll take life easy and eat, drink, and be merry. Death is a teacher, and one of the things that it can teach us is the gap between the question, what sort of life is worth pursuing, and how do you spend your time? Once in a while, something or someone causes me to take stock in this way. And I say, yes, someday soon I'm going to be in better touch with my friends. Someday soon I'll get around to calling that person I've been thinking about. Someday soon, I'll be more disciplined in my prayer life. I'll give my family more attention someday soon. When I finish the project, when I get the room painted, when things slow down, I think a lot of us plan to change. When we get our barns built, when we retire, when the semester is over or the work is done, we need to be reminded more and over again that our lives were made for more, that our lives were made, in the words of the parable, to be rich toward God, and what makes for the flourishing of a godly life. Now, it was a real temptation to me to go further in this direction. I've been thinking a bit about this and what's really important, because we've made the decision to take my mom, to have her come and live with us. She's going to be 95 in September, and she's just sold her house. And I'm not saying that this is what everybody should do, not at all. I visit a lot of seniors' homes every week of my life, and most people are very happy there. And we don't have enough nursing homes. But it just so happens that I think that this is what we should do. And I shouldn't take any credit, because my husband is the one who drives her to her appointments and mostly gets her groceries and runs over with his blood pressure cuff when she's nervous about something and she needs attention. And he'll probably keep doing that. I know he will. But it's the reaction that I've heard from people, even my own family. It's going to cramp your style. You've earned the right for the two of you to be together, to have quiet. Even my own siblings are telling me, you know, mom's not the easiest, all this sort of thing. And I've been thinking about this, you know, a lot. It's not just money in it that consumes us. It's our independence. It's our quietness. It's our time. It's our energies. All these things that we are so parsimonious about sharing. At any rate, as I said, it's a temptation to kind of go further in that direction. But, you know, money is not a favorite topic of most preachers. And congregations are reported to be even less in favor of hearing about it. But I don't think that you can get away from talking about money when you deal with this parable. The reading did start with a request to Jesus to settle a dispute, an inheritance, whether it was money or land. And Jesus warns, be on your guard against greed, all kinds of it, because a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions, nor, of course, does a woman's. And then Jesus tells the parable about a certain rich man who he later referred to as a fool. I think that this parable is about wealth, as to some extent are the verses that follow. So we will go in that direction, like it or not. I think that our perception of what constitutes wealth is relative. We would have to agree, I think, that in comparison with most of the world's people, we are rich, though we fail often to see it. Now, Millard Fuller, he's the founder of Habitat for Humanity. He was recalling on public radio in the U.S. a workshop he did at Pittsburgh Seminary with 200 ministers in attendance. And this is what he says. The assembled pastors quickly pointed toward greed and selfishness as reasons why their churches never had enough money to assist others creatively or to take part in things like Habitat for Humanity. So Millard then asked them this seemingly innocent question. Is it possible for a person to build a house so large that it's sinful in the eyes of God? Raise your hands if you think so. All 200 pastors raised their hands. Okay, said Millard. Then can you tell me at exactly what size, the precise square footage, a certain house becomes sinful to occupy? silence from the pastors. You could have heard a pin drop. Finally, a small, quiet voice spoke up from the back of the room, "When it's bigger than mine." Isn't that the way? Greed is always someone else's problem. We just want enough money so that we won't have to worry about it. Does such an amount ever exist? I find the most explicit thing that Jesus has to say about money or what money can buy is neither put in a parable or an aphorism. It's absolutely clearly stated. It's part of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6. Do not lay up for yourselves treasure on earth, where moth and rust consume, where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth or rust consumes, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And it was repeated in a bit shorter form in our text today. The intent of this text is not to compare the temporary with the permanent, the instability of earth with the utter reliability of heaven, but rather to highlight the place of human affection. On what do you set your heart? On what do I set my heart? Jesus says, "Give to something and it will begin to mean much to you." Now, it works this way, if you think about it. If you want to care more about the car you drive, then you will buy an expensive car, not a beat-up jalopy. If you want to care more about property values, you'll remodel your house. If you want to grow in faith, Jesus says, you bring an offering to God, because where your money goes, your heart will follow after. Peter Gomes, chaplain at Harvard, in his book, The Good Book, and a chapter on the Bible and wealth, says this: Jesus is not necessarily against earthly treasure, but he is against the seductions and illusions by which humans are tempted to worship only that which they can see and quantify. Riches themselves are completely neutral, but the effect that they have can be destructive on those who have them and love them and seek after them. And I think the fact that wealth is seen by Jesus as neutral is illustrated elsewhere in the Gospels by how he uses the wise use of money to make a moral point, as with the parable of the talents or the parable of the unjust steward and his encounter with the tax collector Zacchaeus. He doesn't condemn Zacchaeus' wealth. Zacchaeus freely gives as an act of repentance and restitution, and I don't read anything about what Jesus says he should do with what's left over. Wealth for Jesus is a subordinate good. It's a means rather than an end. And the trick to moral living is not to confuse the means with the ends. Those with wealth have a responsibility to use it wisely, not to hoard it or to spend it only for themselves. Now, this could be developed, of course, in a stewardship sermon. Now, the New Testament makes it clear that how one uses wealth in this life has very significant consequences for the life to come, which lasts a whole lot longer. The parable of the rich man and the poor beggar Lazarus is an illustration. Perhaps you remember it. The rich man assumed his wealth was his to use as he wished, and he failed to give so much as a crust of bread to the beggar who sat day after day at his gate. Both die. Lazarus went to heaven and the rich man to Hades, where he is in torment. And when he asks for relief, Abraham says, "Son, remember, you in your lifetime received good things, and Lazarus in like manner evil things, but now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish." That's a parable I have to preach on in September. Huh, I just looked it up yesterday. Well, check the date. Anthony's away. Well, anyway, we'll save that for that day. Like the rich man who intended to pull down his barns and build better ones, that man, too, had devoted all his energy to amassing property, and neither had anything left, in the end, that they could call their own. They couldn't take it with them, and death disclosed their essential poverty. They were not rich toward God. But in the reading today, it's plain that wealth is a peril, not just to those who have it, but also to those who don't have it. Because Jesus turns to his disciples when he finished the parable to men who definitely were not rich. In fact, many of them had given up their livelihoods to come and follow him. And he denounces the worrying about what they don't have. Jesus labels anxiety in this text as pagan, something that is characteristic of those who have no relationship with God. Now, I don't think for a moment that Jesus is ordering his people or his disciples or you and I today to live in a shiftless or a reckless way, failing to live up to family responsibilities, not caring for the people in our lives, not paying our bills, not getting insurance. There's no thought of that. We're to take responsibility for our needs and the needs of others we are responsible for, and we're to leave the rest to God. That's basically what Jesus is saying. He sees that worrying about material things is an insidious threat to discipleship, because insecurity can take all our attention and can sap our resolve. Nothing is more likely to distract disciples from wholehearted devotion to the kingdom than worrying. In his case, as he mentions, what you'll wear, what you'll eat, the smaller things in life. They will fail, we will fail, to dare, to take a risk for God's sake if we're always worrying about whether there's going to be enough. It's pointless to worry, Jesus says. As the rich fool learned, anxiety cannot add one single hour to his life. Nor is it any more effective when it comes to other things. It's pagan to worry, because it implies that we do not really believe that God is our generous Father. It is a sign of failure to trust. The real cure then for worry is to put first things first, to care more about God's kingdom than about personal needs. Those who do so find that God provides for his servants. They also find that the necessities of life are fewer and simpler than selfishness supposes them to be. So what sort of life is worth pursuing if so much can melt away in an instant? It begins with a new concept of wealth. And there's one ready and waiting in the Bible for all those who thought that possessions would lead to pleasure and security. Because wealth is not what you have. Wealth is what you have been given that enables you to give to others. This is what Jesus calls being rich toward God. Amen.